After we recorded the following conversation, probably sometime around mid-August, news broke that Hillsong Church founder Brian Houston was found not guilty of concealing his father's child sex crimes. The story's all over the place. Feel free to Google and read for yourself. And now for the episode.
All right, I'll forewarn you, this is a tough one to listen to. I consider myself to have, I've got a pastoral heart, and to think of such deep hurt at the hands of a church that someone invests their time and resources and trust in, only for that trust to be taken advantage of, it's a tough pill to swallow. So in the wake of a church being exposed of bad things going on behind the scenes, many are left questioning whether any of it was good. Some of the people who are questioning having had immense spiritual growth at that particular church where some of the bad stuff is coming out. So this is a conversation about one of those churches, Hillsong Church. The corruption at Hillsong has been covered now in two multi-episode documentaries, the latest called Secrets of Hillsong, which serves as a launch pad for this discussion on the many questions so many people are asking when a church like this is found to be full of corruption. So it looks like we have a J team today. It's Joey, Jack, and our lead guy, Josh Surratt.
Just because I don't believe or agree doesn't mean I can't learn from you.
Why did you have to bring that up?
Okay, that one I'm super embarrassed about.
Do you like me?
Do I like you?
Yeah.
As an individual or
as a
podcast?
Yeah, just as a person.
No, I like you.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I don't have any interest in appearing to be stronger than I am.
I ain't bowed to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. He gonna lead. You feel me?
How do we love people who see the world differently than we do?
What would it look like if we truly loved all of our neighbors? Could listening to their stories be the first step? This is Seacoast Church, and there's way more to talk about.
Good to be with you guys. What's up?
Hey.
You like Jack, right?
Most days, yeah.
Yeah, most days. The documentary that we're going to talk about was very heavy for me. This is a very important topic for me. So as I get older, sometimes I want to write my thoughts down so I don't, you know, miss a beat or anything. So I'm going to read something to you guys.
Yeah, maybe we should ask Joey to treat every topic as an important topic.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing I was going to say is, you know, we're not doing this on these podcasts on video yet. So for everyone who can't see, everything is written down in crayon. One word per sheet of paper.
With some pictures.
Pictures. Yeah.
All right. So let's assume in the case, and in this case, that the leader is 100% crooked. Let's just assume that. Wouldn't it be a foolish notion, especially in churches with so many people, that not one person, a part of a particular church, maintain good sight of the gospel, with good being the result? Such good, I think, in many cases, that would justify the existence of the church in the first place, despite crooked leadership. So look at Daniel. He worked in a crooked system, and for the most part was obedient to an evil leader to the point of the leader embracing him. And that's an understatement. And the Bible specifically talks about Daniel as kind of being upper level. So is Daniel bad for working under bad leadership? Did his good not count for something? So back to the church, I'd say anywhere there's true connection, true community, true seeking of the Lord, and or true generosity, there is good. And there's a lot of generous churches. I know there's a lot of people, it's convenient for them to say, no, all churches are bad. And I think we could all relate to the sort of mob thinking. We're all thinking as a group, and it's like, oh, there's an example. See, it fits my narrative. But bottom line, there's tons of generous churches, and I don't even have to touch Seacoast. In Charleston, there is a nonprofit started in 1989 after Hurricane Hugo. They started off just giving food. Now they're giving food. They're helping people with job interview training. They're donating money to people that, I mean, it's full force, and it's all run by the church. So all this to say, of course, good came out of the collection of people at Hillsong, because I guarantee there were at least 10, and I'm, you know, being silly, real believers who were trying to live out the gospel, truly penetrated hearts that yield good fruit. Now, I do think it's fair and important to sometimes ask whether the church does more harm than good. And I do believe there are likely times when a leader falls, formally ending a church family. But if there was a scoreboard that kept track, good outweighs the bad. I think there's probably situations where that's the case. So I'll close. I know y'all are happy that I'm closing by saying,
this doesn't feel like it's going very well, does
no,
it?
No, this is like, when did this turn into talk radio?
But I wish we could see that there are dedicated seekers of Jesus and his teachings are in way more places than just churches with good-hearted leaders. And wherever the sacrificial love of Jesus dwells in the hearts of his children, no matter where they are connected, whatever church, good will result. So you guys know me. I can get kind of feisty about this sort of hypocrisy in the church. I know it doesn't sit well with God. I was appalled by, I mean, appalled, that seems almost like angry. I was burdened. It was very heavy watching this. I've seen a lot of people who've gone through bad church situations, and it's like they question everything. And I don't think that that's necessary. I think that God is big enough to be able to work in any situation. Y'all like that? That sound kind of smart?
This is deep.
Deep?
It's deep. I mean, I do. I think that there's extremes you can take on either side of it. One being your first sentence, which is, I think, one of those potential mob mentalities that because somebody ended poorly or went down a track that took them to hurting a lot of people, that they are evil or, did you say evil or terrible? Ill-intended.
Sure. Yeah.
That's probably the case for some small amount of leaders in the church, that they got into it because they wanted some ill gain. But I would just say, I think it's a pretty small minority, only because there are a lot better ways to manipulate people and take advantage of people than going into ministry with ill intent. But yeah, I think you can take extremes on all sides of these issues and label them as all good or all bad. But yeah, I mean, I would guess that there are a lot more than 10 people within the Hillsong flow that were serving Jesus, love Jesus, and it can actually be admirable at times to overlook a flaw of a leader for the greater good. Now, obviously, if it becomes abusive or it becomes blatant, that's where I think you can get in trouble.
Yeah. I've never read this verse this way, but when it comes to pastors who started with good intentions and then maybe let the love of money or power, but think about these situations and then this verse, I've never read it in this way, but it hit me. The seed falling among the thorns refers to someone who hears the word, but the worries of this life and the deceitfulness of wealth choke the word, making it unfruitful. So thorns, referring to someone who hears the word and says, hey, I want to spread the word. Oops, stuff choked it.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'll say to, you know, something you kind of mentioned a minute ago, and this is something that people tend to do and tend to talk about when we talk about churches or situations like this has, you know, either abuse or difficulty or, you know, whatever. And sort of the idea is like, but, you know, God worked there and good came out of it. And that's always true. I think one thing, though, that I in my experience, Christians sometimes do is they'll take a verse like Romans 8:28, for we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purpose, and say, and therefore, sometimes they say, and therefore this bad thing that happened to me had to happen for some reason. It's like, no, that's not true. Just because God uses terrible things and is able to make terrible things work for good does not make those things good. I was reading about a couple who, husband and wife, who met in a concentration camp and had been married for like 60 years, had kids and grandkids. Like, now that is an unambiguous good that came out of the Holocaust. Absolutely no one is going to say, well, then, you know what?
Holocaust was worth it.
You know what? Worth a second look? It's right. Like, no, that'd be insane. And I think sometimes there is a tendency to say, well, God was at work there, and so maybe it was okay. It's like, I think right. We need to be real careful about
and
doing that.
And I'm not saying that.
No,
just,
I know.
Just so you know.
But I've seen, you know, just some, there's another podcast about some church stuff last year, and that was kind of one of the things that kind of came up is that, you know, God clearly worked, and does that make it a little bit more complicated? Like, does it mean that we really can't take that mob mentality? Yeah, it does. Because things are complicated and people are complicated. But I do think sometimes there is a desire that we have as Christians to say, well, God was working and therefore, you know, maybe it was okay. It's like, I think we need to be careful about that sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, and I think there's different perspectives to look at like a situation like Hillsong. There's three guys sitting in a room talking about, you know, maybe the what happened and how it got there. And we would have a perspective. You also have three guys who are also in ministry who would be asking questions like, how do we make sure something like this doesn't happen to us, which is a productive conversation. But then I think to your point, Jack, like you do have these tens of thousands of people who were a part of the church and are trying to make sense now of what about what God did in my life as a result of that ministry. And that's where I think using Romans 8:28 to go, see, these churches are all great is problematic, but I think from the perspective of that person in the church trying to make sense of, was any of this real? I think it's like, yeah, of course God used flawed people to make a major impact in your life. And I say that because Miles, my son, he's 16 now, but when he was 7, I actually took him to a Hillsong conference in New York. And so that's the first time he heard Carl preach. And then a couple of years later, Carl wrote this book. We got that for Miles as one of his birthday presents or Christmas presents one year. And I think he read that book 4 or 5 times because he just really resonated with it. And so after all this stuff went down, it was really, really hard for him to process what about all of this. And it was like, hey, because the guy did some stupid things. And again, we don't know all, I didn't know at the time and still don't know all that was going on into that. But it doesn't mean that the words that he used, that wrote, that impacted your life don't still have meaning and value and truth. Right. And so I think that's where...
Yeah, we still read the Psalms.
Right.
You know? Now, I will say, equally important, I think that the reason why it is necessary in conversations like this and with Hillsong for people to say, wait, that is wrong, is because there's real people hurt by the corruption and they need fellow brothers and sisters to kind of stand by their side and say, nope, this was bad. It went awry, because it's not helping hurting people to make less of it. And I think that it increases the chances of it happening again with that same person, mm-hmm. because we're all trying to minimize and say, no, you know, it wasn't that bad. Here's what was really hard for me, and Josh, I'm curious if you think this is even an important thing to discuss, but it really felt eerie watching how Hillsong started. It felt like they were bad intentions from the get-go. And what I mean is, it sounded like the lead guy, when he came to America and saw the sort of name it, claim it theology, bring in the good
prosperity gospel.
Prosperity gospel. It looked like, oh, well, that's what I want to do. Let's head back to Australia and get things cooking. That's what it felt like. It felt like, man, was he one of the guys that started with bad intentions? And we'll never know.
Are you talking about the main founder or the like leader of Hillsong, Brian Houston?
Yeah.
See, I would say that's a totally false narrative.
Yeah.
Because Hillsong was wildly successful before it ever came to America. I mean, it was tens of thousands of people in Australia.
No. In the documentary, he observed what was going on in America
and saw
the culture of prosperity
and
gospel.
And wanted to come put that here. I got you. I thought you meant like the reason they started Hillsong was because of how great Hillsong New York was doing.
And it seemed like the documentary was inferring that. So maybe it's speculative, but it definitely lended itself to feel that way. I mean...
Well, I guess what I would say is like, who knows? Like, I don't know Brian. Like, you know, I can know nothing about him, so I can't say. Well, what I would say though is, even if that was true, like even if the worst was true, it would still be, to my mind, Hillsong having been started by one bad person, surrounded by probably a lot of really good people. And so, you know, and that's one of the problems with documentaries like this in terms of like how they flatten everything. Like, Hillsong was never just one person. It was a group of people who kind of shared a vision. One of the things that you realize is, or you have to kind of keep in mind, is there are very few people who are, almost no one is all good or all bad. Everyone is complicated. But I think the deal is, you know, the majority of people who do what it takes to plant a church do so because they sincerely believe in what they're doing. Like, if you think that planting a church is your way to like grift, like I just, like you said, oh, like get a better plan. There are easier ways to do that. Even if the worst happened to be true about Brian Houston, the other thing that would be true is that was him and a group of genuine believers who really wanted to do something great for God. You cannot just flatten everything to founder bad, church bad. It just doesn't work that way.
I don't know that there was a movement that was more impactful in good ways in the last 30 years in Hillsong Church. And I say that right now, today. I also don't know that there's one that's hurt more people. Like, so it's such a mixed bag. But man, the amount of people that have given their life to Christ, the amount of lives, the amount of people that really saw no need for church or no relevance for church that now are in church, loving Jesus. You know, I think my perspective may be different than maybe yours, Joey, maybe you too, Jack. But gosh, from Darlene Check, you know, in the 90s, which completely changed the music and the worship at Seacoast in what I would call really good ways, that have set the table for a lot of good things that are happening now. I still have a hard time looking back at the ministry of Hillsong Church and saying evil person, evil ministry. Like, to me, that's not an accurate depiction of it.
Yeah.
But man, gosh, horrible ending, and like so much to learn from how does something that I would say started so, I don't even know if I could say healthy, because I'm like you, Jack. I know Brian and I know Carl very loosely, would not consider either of them close friends, and I'm not convinced either of them would know my name. But I have to think that at some point you have a guy who, when he was a kid, his father was abusing young boys. I don't know how much he knew about that. I imagine it'd be hard to grow up in the home of a pedophile who's also a major Christian leader in a denomination, how that doesn't mess you up in a lot of really crazy ways, but who somehow managed to, in spite of all of that, still do some pretty incredible things in ministry, and then obviously get off track in some pretty terrible ways. It's just such, like you said, Jack, it's such a complicated deal that none of us could really know. I hope he's getting some kind of counsel and sorting some of that stuff out. But I have a hard time looking back and saying that was all bad. Like, that's not my perspective on it at all.
Now, there seemed to be pretty unhealthy lack of transparency when it came to his father.
Yeah.
At least how I've seen less severe things play out at this church, there's been way more transparency. And I know the challenge is a lot greater, because it's like, well, that's my dad, but no excuse.
No. I mean, not making excuses for that at all. And like I said, I don't know how much he knew, but what you hear is that when he did find out, his claim was that the person told him he really didn't want anybody else to know about it. You know, of course, legally doesn't matter, but it would have been probably a good idea for him to record that or get that in writing from that person, because that's the big dispute right now. But they clearly didn't handle that well at all. And so I'm not saying any of that is good. I think that a lot of it was horrible. I'm just saying, when you look at the big picture of what happened through Hillsong, and I would say similar things about Mars Hill, you've got a lot of tough, bad stuff that came out of it. And then you've got a lot of like people that are still changed to this day because of the stuff that came from it. And so I'm not trying to be that guy that we talked about earlier that's like, well, you know, so it was good.
Yeah.
Right. I'm just saying it's complicated.
You know, I think you said, Josh, a second ago, but reflecting on how not to let this happen here. And I think that's a good, and I don't mean this in a sarcastic way, I think that's a good, humble thing to say, but it's like two different planets.
Yeah.
I mean, Jack and I were talking yesterday about the sort of ways that they were spending money and their personal stuff. And Jack, you said something like, I can't even buy a sandwich on my seat.
That's great. Yeah, right. Nick Johnson would be in my office in like 3 minutes if I charge something, like if I charge a food item. It's, yeah. So
you know what I'm saying? I don't even think to myself, man, I hope Seacoast doesn't fall. We're just not even, there's no overlap.
No, 100%. Like, especially with the spending and the elaborate first class, Seacoast Church has never paid for, nor have I, a first class ticket to fly anywhere. And again, I'm not saying that anybody who has ever done that is wrong, but yeah, we just have so many checks and balances. I get really frustrated at times with our accounting team when I see maybe how restrictive it can feel. And that's always in a moment. But when I'm kind of backing up front, I'm like, thank God for an accounting team that makes me frustrated. Yeah. Because
Josh, the lead pastor here, he somehow found out a password for basically IT privileges and was excited. He was just like, I'm not ever forgetting this password
because I need it.
He still has it.
I still use it.
The lead pastor has to sneak around with an IT password. Jack, I think I cut you off.
No, not at all. I was just going to say, like, one of the things I think watching the documentary, I had kind of two feelings at the same time. One of them was, because I finished the documentary yesterday, there's a part of me that watches this and is like, I want to quit. Because, and you know, not really, but like part of me is like, just because, and you mentioned this, the thing about any organization, and it's true of mega churches too, is the larger you are, the, you know, more resources you have, the more people, the greater your ability to hurt and do damage, right? Like our ability to, Seacoast's ability or potential ability to hurt people is just infinitely greater than, you know, like a 20-person church. And that's just true of any organization. That's not a church thing. That's an organizational thing. One thing that I think is good about the documentary for anyone who works in church culture is it really should make you take a look at your own culture and be like, hey, are there any warning signs here? What are there any red flags? But on the flip side, one of the things about the documentary was made me so thankful for Seacoast and Seacoast culture. Cause it's like, I just felt like there is no overlap in culture between what it is like to be at Seacoast and at least, you know, hearing staffers and congregants describe kind of like what Hillsong culture is like. And look, I, you know, what Hillsong culture is like today, like I have no idea. I've never worked at Hillsong, but you know, just some of the things, whether it's the expense accounts or, you know, just some of the access between, you know, like staff or pastors or whatever, it's just like so radically different. Mm-hmm. And like one of the things I've said, you know, one of my jokes that I like to say is that, you know, from my perspective, Seacoast is a church that is staffed by people who are kind of suspicious of mega churches, you know,
that's so
like,
true.
And it's one of my favorite things about kind of mm-hmm. what makes our culture. We really believe that Seacoast is a place where people encounter God, where people find Jesus. There's also a sense that it's like, let's make sure that this thing is like on the rails. And I love that. I have never, you know, had an experience at Seacoast, you know, and I've been here either attending or on staff for like 30 years almost, where I've really had this red flag, like, oh boy, that seems really bad, or what does that mean? I just haven't had those. I've had like, you know, I approved expense reports yesterday, and I literally was like, all right, so the video team just expensed food. I need to find out how long that shoot was because there's a specific hour mark
that they have to meet
to be able to expense that sandwich.
Oh, Nick.
And but like Josh said, I'm thankful for that. As much as it irritates me sometimes, like it's a really good and important thing, and I'm glad we have it.
Well, and I think I would agree with everything that you said there, but I do think that the question for me is how does a leader go from, hey, we're going to sacrifice everything we have, I'm going to quit my job, we're going to build a team and plant a church, and then get to a place where they're so spiritually unhealthy that they make terrible decisions, and whether that be cheating on their wife or getting to a place spiritually where they're not, you know, connected with God at all and trying to lead in a fake way. And so I think those are the kinds of things that I like to ask when I look at something like that is, you know, what is it? And I don't know if I've ever told this story on the podcast. I don't think I have, but I remember about a year after Darren Patrick came on staff with us, and most of you guys know that Darren had a bad ending to his time at the church that he planted, that involved the way he was leading people and some questionable decisions that he made, and he was fired from that church. And so, and then about 2-3 years later, he came on staff here and was here for about a year. And he and I were having lunch, and he was like, "Hey, do I have permission to speak freely to you?" And I was like, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I just want to look at your last couple of months of like travel. You've preached for 2 different churches. You went to an event for pastors that you got invited to. Your family took our kids on a ski trip." And this was like end of February. And there may have been one other thing, I can't remember, but he said, none of those things are bad, by the way, those are all good. But he said, I've noticed something after being here for a year, that you are the dad, the spiritual dad to the staff. He said, your dad is not, your dad is, they all love him, but he's uncle, he's grandpa, he's not the father. You are, but you're not acting like a father. You're still acting like a kid. Kids eat candy whenever they want to, right? You know, kids, anytime it's offered to them, eat candy. But when you become an adult, you realize I actually can't make that decision. I can't eat candy every time it's offered to me. And he said, you're saying yes to any opportunity that you get right now. Opportunities are like candy to you, and you're acting like a kid. And it was like, and he said, the reason I'm telling you that is because the reason I'm not on staff at Journey Church anymore is because I was gone too much. And when you're gone too much, you become isolated, and now you're not getting input or building relationship with your team, leading your team in the way that you're supposed to. And the more isolated you get, the more stupid decisions you make, and the less access people have to speak into your life. And so from that moment, I was like, dude, thank you for saying that to me. And we set up a travel advisory board. Lisa was on it, Kathy, my assistant, Darren, and we would meet like once a quarter in any opportunity that I had. Like, it was almost like a kid with candy with a board that was saying which pieces you can eat, which ones you can't. But it was like, if you say yes to any of these, what are the no's that you're saying? And instead of, you know, what are you saying no to in order to say yes to that? And what are the best yeses? And let's settle that back down. And so I'm always grateful for that, because I feel like when you're dissecting the fall of a leader, again, what was the question that somebody used to ask is, if you were to go out, what would be the thing that took you out? And for some people, it's power. For some people, it's money. Some people, it's lust or sex. Everybody's got different potential derailers. But I think to be able to go, hey, if a common denominator is the leader started getting out of town more than he was in town. A, you're open to other opportunities to fall anyways, but people love you out of town. People think you're great out of town. In town, you have problems. You have staffing issues. You have stuff that you have to say, you know, and so sometimes when those opportunities start coming, it's easy to go, well, I'm going to go do what feels where I'm wanted, loved, yeah, treated like, you know, this versus reality, which is that, man, this is a team and we're leading together and there's problems to solve and there's stuff to figure out. And so anyways, I just think that that was a huge thing for me from Darren that I'm still grateful for, yeah, in his absence, to go, hey, you know, don't ever get isolated from your team, because most of these stories will go back to like, why didn't anybody say no to that? Or right, why, yeah, didn't anybody, right, like call that out?
Yeah. Could have kept the train on the rails for, yeah, a week, you know, you would just never know. Mm-hmm. If anything's going to take Jack out, it's books.
Too what many would that books. Scenario be? Like someone's like bribing me with, yeah.
You're just,
yeah,
reading too much.
I guess.
You know, everybody's like, Jack, we need your help. We do your creative job. And you're like, I'm reading.
yeah, right. You know, one thing, Josh, you said beneath the surface of what you said is one of the things we're really talking about there is accountability. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think is a real commonality with, I don't want to say, you know, I want to challenge, like most leaders that, and I'll keep it church leaders, but most church leaders and pastors who fall or, you know, get fired or any of these things is you just, what comes out is there's just a total lack of accountability. And it's not that their board or their elders or whatever weren't trying. It's, were these leaders making themselves accountable to others? Because if you're not making yourself accountable to other people, if you won't let other people hold you to account, at some point, the only recourse that group will have is to fire you, because that's the only thing they can do.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things you see is if you're not allowing yourself, if you're not holding yourself accountable in small things, then that just snowballs almost every single time. I know, you know, with my team, with creative, you know, probably like 6-7 years ago, we weren't in a great place. And, you know, our my predecessor in the creative director role, Margaret Little, when she came onto the team, one of her big things was accountability. And, you know, we all had like a lot of complaints, like, oh, you know, people need to do this and leadership needs to do this. And, you know, kind of the thing that she and you know, our HR leader at the time kind of said is, hey, look, all of those things might be true and none of them matter. You have to work on you. And one of the biggest things for us was holding ourselves accountable to basically like, hey, treat yourselves like professionals. You want to be taken seriously? You need to be accountable to one another and you need to be accountable to the people that you're serving. You cannot expect them to be accountable to you if you're not accountable to them.
Yeah.
And that was maybe the biggest thing that got us really healthy was accountability was, you know, we all, you know, in creative, we all feel accountable to one another. And I think that's just such a big deal is, you know, if you're a leader, who are you accountable to? Who are you, who can come into your office and tell you something that is really hard? And that you will listen to. And if you can't think of anybody, like, that's just a bomb waiting to go off.
Yeah. A few other things I want to talk about. I got to tell y'all a story, though. So when I was coming on for this role with podcasting, Josh Walters takes me out to lunch. And I'm just, you know, I'm following his lead. He takes me to some Asian restaurant. He orders like a bowl. And I was like, yeah, I'll have what he has. I think he's looking at this lunch special and he's thinking he's ordering according to the lunch special. He's like, okay, and I'll also have that steak that goes with the bowl. And I was just blissfully unaware. I was like, yeah, me too. And so basically it was like we ordered 4 different meals and just didn't realize it. And so when the expense is turned in, we both get a text from Sam Leskin. He's just like, you know, it's not a really good look, you guys dining during work hours and on tithe money. And I even though Walters is younger than me, I did the whole, hey, he's the one that charged it. The whole blame it on the big brother. Hey, Jack and I were reflecting on this yesterday. Obviously, this is all speculative, but it felt like Carl Lentz was in his interviews and the things that he was talking about. It seems like it had broken down to some genuineness and real vulnerability. But we also brought up the potential that what he was good at doing back in New York City, he's still doing as far as deceiving. But Jack, you brought up some really good points as far as it not seeming that way, given his current job. And remember, yeah, the stuff that you brought up?
Yeah. Well, so I knew Carl a little bit, you know, so for me, like I've got a lot of feelings about the documentary stirred up a lot of feelings for me. And It's, you
was
know,
Jack about to cry?
No.
Okay.
But he had a feeling.
Yeah. So. That's right. Yes. Oh no. It's been captured on record. Shoot. I'm ruining my brand. So, you know, one of the things we've said a number of times, and I think it really is one of the things that I really do think is good for people to take away, is that like people are complicated. So every single one, and I really do mean 100% of my interactions with Carl over a few year period were positive. Every single one of them. You know, there was a time where he was one of the most positive voices in my life. But I also know some people at Hillsong who were like traumatically hurt by what he did and kind of how all that went down. That's a confusing thing to process when all of my interactions were not just positive, but actually kind of important for me in that point in my life. And it's like, oh, so which is true? It's like, well, who knows? It's like, I don't, you know, there's almost never a case where an extreme version of somebody is the true story. And so watching the documentary, it's interesting. Like, so there's a sense, you know, where, you know, he seems very contrite, very repentant, and very genuine. And I think one of the tragedies about experiencing that kind of fall is you kind of make it impossible for anyone to just default to believing you ever again. I mean, all of that could be 100% sincere, and you're going to have a lot of people that go, nah, he's still just acting. And I don't think that's unfair. I think that's just, that's one of the things that, you know, you kind of sow when you reap deception, or you reap when you sow deception. And so like, you know, is he genuine? Like, I don't know. But what I will say is, you know, in the last episode, there were some things, you know, that, so if you haven't seen the documentary, the second episode is pretty much entirely about Carl. The fourth episode kind of ties everything up. And so he's in it a lot more. There are a couple things that were interesting to me. One is that I didn't know, because this was never in the media, is he took kind of like this office job at an ad agency. And like he at one point walks you to his tiny little like corner cubicle desk. You see him like in a meeting where he's dressed like Carl Lentz and everyone else is just dressed like a normal office worker, which I thought was really funny. But he's just like in a meeting in a conference room and no one's talking to him or looking at him. He's just like, you know, so he got a job, like just a job, a little desk job. And he's still together with his wife, right? And kids. That's interesting that he kind of took this little nothing job. Right. And it's also interesting at the end, you know, kind of this family meal that they show. And obviously his family's there, which, yeah, could mean anything. But, you know, Laura's parents are there. His wife's parents are there. And to me, that's interesting because to me, that does suggest that family is, they're not just together on tape. Like they're not just putting on a show because right. Hey, we gotta maintain,
like, having anything to do with
that. We gotta maintain this narrative for a public image. Like that felt real. Whatever else is real or not real or whatever. I just like it's not my business. It's not my problem to judge. But that felt real. And so I think, you know, for me, you know, did I ever know Carl? It's like, I don't know. But I did see some things in the documentary that felt a lot like the experiences I had.
Yeah.
For what that's worth.
I'll give mine too. So I only met Carl once, and Lisa and I were in New York. It was their very first 11 o'clock service, which was their early service. And so I remember he apologized several times during the service or thanked people for getting up so early to come to church. Oh my God.
So those lazy New York City.
New York City, those people. But Lisa and I were in a pretty tough spot in our marriage. We just had been fighting a ton. And actually that night, Saturday night at like 1 o'clock in the morning, we were fighting. We were missing each other. And you know, a lot going on in our marriage at that point. And so we get up and we go to church and we don't know Carl. He definitely doesn't know us. We walked in like everybody else did. There was a long line and you walk in and kind of go through this cattle call. And they put us up in the balcony of this, I think it's Irving Plaza is the name of the building. And he spoke, and he spoke about Jonah. It was probably as much to do with where we were in our marriage as it was what he said, because I can't remember a whole lot of what he said, but it just broke us. Like we were just like, and so as soon as the service ended, we walked down full of tears and went to the front. He was standing up front talking and just asked him if he would pray for us. And he spent about 5 minutes with us. Again, doesn't know any at all who we are, prayed for us, gave us his number, and then followed up and text several times over the next couple of weeks to check on us to see how we were doing. And so, like you, Jack, my experiences, and I know in watching the documentary, he made people feel really good about themselves. He was really good at that. He's got a gift for it. And so, again, was it real? Was it not? It was real for us. It made a difference in our life. And so when I look at, like, where's Carl now? And, you know, is this all real? Obviously, the first thing that comes to mind is it's really none of my business.
Yeah, like,
it's between him and God. But if I don't believe that Carl Lentz can be redeemed and can repent and can have, you know, some sort of future being used by God and whatever that will look like in his future, then I sure need to stop doing what I'm doing. Because every single weekend through the doors of our church are stories that are in the middle of their worst brokenness. And so, I mean, for me, I tend to be this guy. I mean, hope is definitely like I think one of my core values and maybe gifts is that I want to always be hopeful and see hope in people. And I think there's definitely a place for proper judgment of, you know, should we let this person back into our lives in this way or back into, you know, all that stuff is important. But I sure hope and believe that the things you said, Jack, I mean, the marriage thing is a big deal. Like that they disappeared for a couple of years. Like it just, you know, completely fell off the radar, which I think is probably a healthy sign. But then they reemerged together, kids still with them, in-laws still with them. And so I'd like to believe that the Jesus that he preached about for a whole long time, sometimes with really bad motives and a lot of stuff going on, met him in his worst place and is redeeming some stuff in his life right now.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. You know, one of the things I thought, I've thought over the years is, so if you think about, like, one of the things that I do not envy pastors who kind of have the reach or some of the congregants that someone like a Carl Lentz does is, so like, you think about, so like, celebrities, like Justin Bieber, kind of the most famous in like Carl Lentz, you know, person, is like, it must be almost impossible to be as famous as Justin Bieber and be a Christian. And I'm not just talking about like behavioral stuff. I'm talking about because like so many people will just never believe you. So many people will just take it for granted as like, oh, you're just trying to reform your image, or oh, it won't stick, or oh, it was never real. Like millions of people think that about you, and it won't matter what you do. You like Justin Bieber could quit touring. He could go work in, you know, he could like go live in a monastery for the rest of his life. And millions of people will still be like, it's not real. And like, that must be almost impossible. Like it kind of put a kind of a different spin on the passage about how difficult it is for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. That burden must be almost crushing. And so it's like, I've always thought like, it must be so hard to minister to someone like that. And now Carl is in that position. It doesn't matter what he does for the rest of his life. So many people will never believe him. And one of the things I've thought over the past few years with regards to Carl is, and I like you said, Josh, like you fully acknowledge there are people who've been hurt and you don't want to minimize that or suggest that they should feel this way what I'm about to say. But one of the things I've thought is like he needs someone to believe him. And even if that means like, and what is it opens you up to being lied to again. But people who have fallen hard, they need someone to believe that God can still work in their lives, like you said. And they need someone to, if they say, like, so I'm doing my best. I am following Jesus to the best of my ability. If they own their sin, if there's real repentance there, like they need somebody to be like, all right, like, I'm going to believe you. I'm going to believe you. Yeah. And it's like, look, I don't flatter myself that like I'm that person, but just, you know, like, they need someone like that in their lives. Yeah. They really, really do.
Well, and that doesn't mean, like you said, it doesn't mean give them the platform again or put them back in a situation where some of those same temptations will come. But I think that at the end of the day, if you read the book that we preach through all the time, you know, it's kind of what God does best. Now, I think the other side of that argument, if there was somebody, if Joey was free to, had permission to speak freely, which you do, you know, I mean, what do you do about the wolves in sheep's clothing? Or what do you do about the, you know, the people who are purposefully trying to lead God's people astray, you know? And I think that, do those people need grace too? Probably. Is it wise to, like, there's wisdom at play that you've got to figure out what's the best way to approach that, in our world.
Yeah, I was laughing at myself because, you know, they would keep showing clips of him preaching while they're talking about the scandal. And there were times where I was like, dadgum, that was good. That got me during the storyline. Do you ever now, or was there ever a time when this sort of thing caused you heartburn, so to speak, because the general spectator of mega churches sees Seacoast one and the same. Yeah. Like, does it ever bother you that we're seen as just like everybody?
I think it does. Probably not as much like what other people think about outside of here, but there are times that even within our own church and within our own staff, you'll have people that came off of a staff of another mm-hmm. large mega church and maybe had a really sour experience with that. And for that to then taint, you know, how they view me or how they view us as a church, I think can be difficult to navigate, because what I want to do is say, hey, I get it. Like I get it that there are really bad mega churches and bad cultures and all of that stuff. But like what here is broken, and let's work on that, because we are not perfect either, obviously. But typically it comes down to, no, it's just baggage that I have from that mega church I used to work for. And so I think that's just, it stinks that we kind of get lumped into one category, and people would assume that because that's what happens in mega churches, it's what happens here. And again, we're trying to do our best to do it as healthy as we can. And like Jack said earlier, like I think our staff would laugh at me if I tried to do some of the things that some of these leaders have done. Like I'd get laughed at, because it's just not, this isn't a culture that tolerates a highly egotistical, you know.
Yeah. Like if any of the lead pastors like rolled up into a meeting with a Cartier watch, like the amount of mockery that you would endure would make it so you never wore it again.
Exactly.
We would make you feel so bad about yourself. It is like one of my, you know, my favorite things about Seacoast is we've always been a place where people who maybe dropped out of church for some reason or been hurt by church kind of found like a home. But one of the things that, you know, I really love is that that's also true for people who join our staff who've been hurt by being on staff mm-hmm. at another church. And that's not just a mega church thing. It's like, there's a lot of hurt that goes on in small churches on staffs. And that to me is something that really does speak to like the health of our culture and also like the proper orientation of our culture around is like, we want to help people walk with Jesus, which is Seacoast is a place where people actually find like rest and healing from yeah. hurt that they've acquired by, you know, being on staff at a mega church or a, you know, small church or whatever. And I think that like really says something really positive about what we're doing.
Yeah. And I think the frustration, to answer your question, Joey, is that sometimes I feel like it takes them too long to believe
yeah.
that there's not some shoe that's going to drop,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
And that was one of the other frustrating things to me about not necessarily the latest documentary. I only saw the first episode of that one, by the way. So I know we're talking about yeah. it. I didn't see the second, third, and fourth. And I will. I did not see it because I felt self-righteous about seeing it. I didn't get to it.
It'll destroy your heart and soul, so maybe don't.
Exactly. But I do think that the prior Hillsong one, the one that the Discovery Channel did, one of the things that frustrated me about that, because I felt like it was like, a lot of it was like, oh, that's awful, and that's true, and that's terrible. And then there were times they would interview people, and here's what I know is you can find people that have had bad experiences at Seacoast, bad experiences on our staff. And I think that all that you said, Jack, is true about the culture and what we strive to do, but we do fall short at times. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people that maybe worked for a leader that was not leading well and didn't get held accountable in enough time, and it caused change. So I just know that if you dig deep enough, you can find a few people who will get up and get on camera and paint a narrative about Seacoast that is largely untrue of what the majority of the people experience. And I think that's part of maybe my hesitation with some of these documentaries is because they are video recorded and they have a story they want to tell. You know, you can find people to tell it. Now, I'm not saying that obviously there's enough stuff in Hillsong that like the stuff is true and it's terrible. But I do just, there's part of me that was like, man, if you wanted to, if a filmmaker said, hey, I've got millions of dollars and we're going to do a story on Seacoast, I'll bet they could find some people in an interview that their true experience was hard because we aren't perfect and people make mistakes. But I do think that and know that largely the experience that Jack's talking about, I mean, I know it's been my experience and I lead the place, but I didn't always. I was on staff here for longer than I've led it. And so I know that the culture is largely healthy.
Yeah. Well, and I think the thing about, you know, finding people who, you know, would be delighted to go on record and criticize. Like, that's true of every single organization. One of the things I think about documentaries like this, and I think this one did this too. Overall, I thought this was a pretty fair documentary. But I do think sometimes they dip into the unspoken, all churches need to be held to account for this reason. And it's like, listen, every single organization on the planet of every size has frustrated, hurt people because of that organization. So what does that tell you? Nothing necessarily in and of itself, other than people hurt people. And if you get an organization full of people, they're going to produce some hurt people. Yeah, you know, so I think that's the problem. It's like generalizing to, oh, this is a church problem. It's like, well, yeah, it's a church problem. It's also a fast food problem. And, you know, like every industry, every single organization, right down to every single group of friends, right, is going to hurt people from time to time. That's just what humans do. Sometimes intentionally, sometimes not intentionally, most of the time not intentionally.
Yeah. And when you dig deeper into the way they spent money or the, you know,
yeah,
like,
right.
I think that's where you see, like, there was more intent than just flawed people doing stuff like that. But yeah. Anyways, it's just, I have a little bit of cynicism watching a documentary that needs people to watch it in order for it to pay for itself.
Yeah. Jack, how would you feel if one time in a sermon, Josh is just talking about some stuff and then he starts talking about, you know, deception in the church and everything. He said something along the lines of, hey, you know, some of these churches, beware of them. Beware of this sort of leadership. Here's some things to look out for. I love you. I don't want you to get hurt.
Well, let me generalize it away from Josh. Because, you know,
he doesn't listen to most of it.
I've never been to church. Let me broaden it out. In general, I think it's kind of bad form for Christians to publicly criticize other Christians in the same way as it's like, look, you got family problems, like you deal with those internally, right? If you got a problem with your brother or a cousin, just don't go on social media and blast them. That's just kind of my thing. Like, you got family stuff, like deal with it. But you don't kind of say publicly, beware of people like this. I think that's bad form. What I would say is, hey, listen, here are some tendencies that some leaders have, or here are some common characteristics in unhealthy leadership. Will you please watch us? We want to make sure, here's some of these safeguards that we have to not fall into them, but we need you to hold us accountable. Because those other leaders are kind of irrelevant as far as Seacoast goes, because they don't pastor Seacoast people. They pastor their people. I think it's good to say, hey, let's talk about some, some dangers or some leadership common issues. But it really, your job is to point the flashlight at yourself and say, hey, we need you to hold us accountable.
And maybe if it's like, hey, we're moving to another city and looking for a church. Hey, here are some things to look for in healthy leadership or healthy cultures.
Right.
And here are some things to be aware of if they're not, or just watch Seacoast Online.
Josh, I know you'll give me a straight answer with this, and it's a heavy thing to bring up, but how do you all think it would go down at Seacoast in a fictitious world where corruption was found in the Surratt family, like major consistent corruption that was going back years? I thought about this, and there's a part of me that's like, you know, it's not like you guys teach every single week. It's not like y'all are the success of the church. So there's a part of me that feels like we would be able to survive that and continue on as a church. But then there's another part of me that's just like, I think people would be so freaking heartbroken that maybe that would be a tough task.
I think it'd be brutal. I think it'd be, just thinking about from my own family standpoint, like, we were talking with a family about a month ago and we were working on a family mission thing that we're doing, like a mission statement, and each of the kids have their own one. And my son said, just talking about, like, he was describing our family and he said, it's like a tsunami of faith that I can't escape from. And he said, I know, like, I've got friends and I'm not perfect and people make decisions, but he said, this legacy of faith is like something that I just, it creates security and safety in me to know, like, I'm on this track and I'm going to make I know I have to make these decisions myself. And
he's done a lot better than you were at that age.
Way better. But, so I think it would be brutal because I think that we've tried to live as a family, as best as we can, a church family, invite people in. But I have no question that the church would do fine. One of the benefits, and it's not the why, but one of the benefits of a teaching team approach and a shared leadership approach is not just like, what if we did something corrupt or stupid, but what if we, you know, I got hit by a bus. I think people would be sad for a little bit, and then I think the church would move on. And I think that's how it should be. So that's ultimately the goal. And I've told our staff this, not just for me, but I think all of us, is that we're stewards. And hopefully, you know, by the time our season of leading whatever we're leading is done, like somebody else can take it and make it better and take it to the next level. But I really do think that the church would be fine, you know, long term. I'm not saying like, oh, I could go do something stupid. I think it'd be super hard.
Yeah, I think fine may be a little.
I think it would be okay in the long run.
It would last.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. I look at like New Spring. I think most of us would have said prior to New Spring, Perry Noble being removed from their church, that man, if something happened to Perry, that church is gone, because he was such a dynamic. And I actually am very good friends with Brad Cooper, who is one of the current lead pastors of New Spring. We text a good bit. I think that church is about as healthy as you could imagine it being, especially in the wake of something like that. And they also do a shared leadership model where, you know, multiple people teach, and it's not built on one personality. And I think that that would create an environment where we'd have as good a shot as anybody to come through it and continue to be a healthy church.
Yeah. So Jack, if that were to happen, who would you put in charge? Chip Judd?
Oh my gosh.
Josh Walters or Lynn Stroy?
Oh, Lynn. What? It's not even.
Before I knew once I got to the third one.
Before
like, oh,
you
easy.
Said Lynn, I was like, surely you could have come up with some different names. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Lynn, what is even that question?
Thanks for listening. There's a link in the show notes to our podcast Facebook page where we talk about these episodes and share some behind-the-scenes information, including guests we're booking. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Information, including guests we're booking. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.